Welcome back to the Autoblog Podcast. I'm Greg Migliori. We have an awesome show for you this week. We are going to talk about all things Tesla. There's a new Model 3 performance that, as you can imagine, is high performance. We'll talk about Tesla's first quarter performance. Of course, we'll talk about some things that are, you know, also a little more fun, lighthearted, like a Mercedes G-Class. There is a new Galanda wagon. We'll talk about the Ford Mustang's 60th anniversary, where our senior editor for All Things Consumer, Jeremy Korsnewski, was there. He was at the birthday party. Talk about a couple other news things and review some cars like the BMW X2 and the Mazda CX-90 long-termer. So with that, Jeremy, who's wearing, I believe, a Leelanau hat, welcome.
I am indeed, yeah. Leelanau Winery, actually.
Nice.
And on the back, it says, drink in Michigan, which I'm not currently doing because we're here working, recording. I got some coffee here, but drinking in Michigan sounds pretty good right now.
It really does. It really does. And Leelanau has plenty of great, wineries, wine cellars, things like that. I just went to one of them a couple months ago, actually, on a trip up to Traverse City. So that was all good wine up there, it seems like.
Yeah. It's actually surprising for someone who lived so long in the West Coast like I did. Mm-hmm. You got used to drinking, really heavy reds and really dry whites. And moving to the Midwest, I thought, oh, I'm not going to get that kind of wine here. You sure can. The grapes, the varietals are going to be different. But if you like dries, heavy, bold, you'll find it. It's less common. Midwesterners seem to like their sweeter wines a little bit more than West Coasters do, but it's there when you look.
I tend to prefer more of the West Coast vibe, that crisper, especially like a white wine, like a Pinot Gris, but Michigan does do Rieslings pretty well. I went to a vineyard called Mari Vineyards, which had a lovely red. I forget which one it was, but yeah. Boy, I really could go for a glass of wine now. I think I'm flush out of most of it. I think I might have a late harvest Riesling from Black Star Farms, another great Michigan
that is a Michigan
vineyard.
Yeah.
But I don't have any red, and I really could go for a glass of red.
You know what? I live in a very old home, and we'll get to talking about cars, but I live in a very old home, and the basement is not good for much. It's just, it's dug out. It is like rocks stacked on each other, made into a foundation. But it's excellent. The humidity level and the temperature level are perfect for wine. So we've got a little wine cellar down in our basement, which is perfect whenever a tornado warning goes off because we got to go down there. We may as well open up a bottle out of the wine library.
So speaking of tornadoes, how about we talk about Tesla? How do you like
boy.
That for the transmission?
Oh, yeah. Man,
I need like a drum rib shot for that.
I mean, you're getting good at this podcast hosting duty, Greg.
It's taken a while. But hey, so Tesla reported, I would say, lackluster earnings, but, by Tesla standards, it was their first revenue drop in 4 years. They still made money and they still sold a fairly, healthy amount of cars, but they were below expectations. The big takeaway here, though, is Elon Musk said, hey, we're still going to do this low-cost vehicle. We think it might be called the Model 2. That would make sense. And he's also going to do robo-taxis. So it's like he's sort of kind of, I think, absorbed the criticism that he's received since that Reuters report came out saying that he's junking the Model 2 in favor of robo-taxis. But it's like, I heard you, but we're still going to do it my way, which means they're going to spend a fair amount of money trying to put the world in robo-taxis. And that's sort of like the top line, too long, don't read summary of it. There's plenty of other things too. What's your take on the state of Tesla?
It's weird having been in the industry watching things for so long to see Tesla early valuation, like just fly through the roof based on what people think Tesla could potentially end up being. And then watching as Tesla climbed to actually fulfill what the early investors thought it might be. When you look around, the Tesla Model Y is the best-selling vehicle nameplate in the world.
Yeah.
That's kind of crazy to think about. Like when, they build these things in, they're not just all built in California anymore. They've got factories in China and Germany, and they assemble these things and they ship them out at huge numbers. People think like, oh, Ford F-Series, best-selling vehicle in America. You know what outsold the Ford F-Series last year globally? The Tesla Model Y. So when you start looking at the financials of a company like Tesla now, they're no longer being judged solely on what they may be able to do, what their projections are. They've hit those projections, and now it's no longer like, well, let's just think about what this company could be. It's now just like any other company in the world that is being judged on what it's actually doing, which is kind of funny, because when you look what they're actually doing, they are selling a huge number of vehicles. Mm-hmm. So back when they were selling like super small amounts of vehicles, you know, investors were like, oh, there's so much potential here. Their market cap accelerated past, like, you know, companies like General Motors, Toyota, and Volkswagen that just sell, like, you know, millions and millions of vehicles every year. And suddenly Tesla becomes a big car company, and they're no longer being treated as the Silicon Valley darling. They're being actually judged on their performance like any other car company. We see stock drops, but it is important to note that Tesla still is the world's largest car company on market value. It's dropped from some of the stratospheric heights. The next new thing that investors are looking at is, moving into lower cost models and robo-taxis, which is what Greg just brought out. So those things are coming. We're seeing a little bit of Elon Musk saying like, all right, I heard you. I think if you read between the lines, it's very likely that the Reuters story was more true than false, even though he, blew it up as fake news on Twitter, as Elon Musk is likely to do. He blew it up as fake news. I don't think it was. I think they were reporting on the actuality of Tesla postponing cheaper models in an effort to get the, you know, robo-taxi dreams more rooted in reality, hoping that, you know, that is going to goose the stock market price more than the low-cost model. Then the low-cost model, like, delays got reported. He's like, fake news. Not coincidentally, on the next stock earnings call, report call that was just last night, he's like, yeah, we're doing low-cost cars. There's actually a lot of questions on what it's going to be, though, Greg. Did you look? He mentioned like some things about maybe decontenting some of their current cars to make lower prices instead of coming out with a completely different model. Like, no one really knows what Tesla's lower cost model is going to be so much. I think people were happy to hear him address it and say, like, yeah, that's not off the table. We want to prioritize robotaxis above this, but lower cost models are not off the table. And that's important, because you look at China, BYD, Geely, all these, you know, several other companies that are headquartered and based in China are just killing Tesla, even though Teslas are being repriced to kind of go along with market realities. They're still not as cheap as what you can get in China. So it's kind of a weird inflection point for Tesla. For people who have been used to watching the stock for a really long time, it probably feels weird to see them judged on their actual performance, as opposed to, you know, like, just, we have faith. And now it's like, ooh, is faith waning because, you know, things are more like we're looking at realities as opposed to expectations now? It's kind of a weird spot for Tesla to be in.
I think the robo-taxi situation became almost like a wedge issue, because, or like a trigger almost for industry watchers and Wall Street, because it's sort of the graveyard of where automakers go to waste money. If you look at General Motors with Cruise, Ford with Argo AI, and Volkswagen and Amazon. So, you know, we've talked about this before on the podcast. It's very questionable, the ROI there, even though it's obviously like a very forward-looking tech. So
for sure.
Yeah. I think that really got people fired up.
Yeah, I think so. The stock did, even though profits were down and revenues were down, you mentioned that, still a profitable company, but stock actually rebounded a little bit after, you know, so they, you know, people who are apparently smarter than me, sometimes I question that, but apparently smarter than me and know how to make money on money, are looking at this and saying like, oh yeah, okay, we are going to take Elon Musk at his word and this robotaxi stuff has legs. Longtime podcast listeners probably know that I own a Tesla, a 2023 Model 3 model, moving on. I had the free month of full self-driving that every Tesla owner just got. I am here to tell you, don't use this as stock market advice. Don't, you know, say, oh, you know, Jeremy Korzynski at Autoblog said this and I'm not going to buy Tesla stock. I do not see this robotaxi thing as a short-term money-making opportunity. We were actually talking about it in our, you know, kind of internal texting Slack. For those of you who work in office environments, you definitely know what Slack is. And someone was like, man, I can't see people who would just have these personal cars, these Teslas, thinking like, oh yeah, I'm going to let a whole bunch of people use my vehicle and they're all going to be, you know, robo taxis. And like, literally that means robot taxi. They're self-driven taxis is what the promise is. Man, I use this full self-driving and I am ultra aware of what's happening behind the wheel. I absolutely, and this is just a personal opinion, you know, as a Tesla owner, I don't want hundreds of thousands of these things picking up passengers and dropping them off, you know, at their destinations. Let me be the first one to say, as someone who tested it for a month, it is not ready for that. Absolutely not ready for that. My car, which is fully equipped, it's a 2023 model. It's got the, you know, new computer, it's full neural net, end to end, blah, blah, blah. It cuts corners and hits curbs and wants to drive into, you know, dips in the median when it's making left turns across traffic. It, you know, it pulls up really gingerly to a stop sign, but then slams on the gas afterwards and slams on the brakes. I'm like, do we want hundreds of thousands of these things driving on public roads along with, you know, my 16-year-old niece and nephew that are, you know, like learning to drive and need predictability on the road from other drivers? Like, man, is this really what we want? I mean, Wall Street apparently does, because, you know, Tesla says, Elon Musk says Tesla robotaxi and people are like, yeah, I'm buying that. But man, I don't know, just like the real world impact of that. Is this what we want?
I don't know if it is or not. I think, you know, Musk has been ahead of the curve on things like infrastructure and just the EV market in general, you know, expansion in China. So I wouldn't bet against him. I also think in this case, I think he almost got like his hand slapped a little bit with that Reuters report.
Yeah.
I think almost like the adults in like the other rooms were like, no, what are you doing, man? Mm-hmm. You're saying a lot of things on a lot of different subjects. Now you're not going to do the thing, a smaller or a lesser expensive car that everybody thinks you need to do. You're mm-hmm. not going to do that, but you're going to do a robotaxi. Mm-hmm. Come on, man. And I feel like that really oddly seems to have hit home, because yeah. then he pulled out all the stops. You know, he showed, you know, he said they're going to do the robotaxis because, of course, he's not going to back down there. But he did say they're going to do this lower cost vehicle. Mm-hmm. He confirmed that again. And then they showed things like the model, the Model 3 performance.
Yeah.
The names start to blur together with the Tesla lineup. And 510 horsepower, 0 to 60 in 2.9 seconds.
Yep.
To me, that's like an exclamation point. Like, pull out all the stops here to try to change the narrative. And I think he did that yesterday, because apparently stock is going crazy.
Yeah, it's rebounded.
I don't know if I agree with him, but...
No, I totally... Yeah, This is an automotive enthusiast podcast. This is not a, you know, this is what you should base your financial earnings reports and what stocks you should buy kind of podcast. But I do think it's interesting that on the same day that they're talking about, you know, new lower cost models, they introduce the highest cost version of the Model 3. And I think that's a reflection of the realism that Tesla has to face right now. Now they're a real car company. You know, they're no longer a stock darling. Now they're a real car company that has to, you know, put their money where their mouth is. And I think there's a lot of different kind of people who are Tesla fans. I'm a Tesla owner. I wouldn't say I'm a Tesla fan. I see, you know, they're talking about lower cost models, and I'm like, well, that'd be great for, you know, a lot of people that want to get into EV ownership. But I mean, my Tesla Model 3 was $40,000, maybe 42 after delivery fees, and you know, I did the white interior. That is already significantly lower than the average cost of a new car in America. The fact that they were able to make this performance version, dual motor, crazy horsepower numbers, amazing acceleration. And I've heard from some other journalists who I respect, Jason Camisa, for instance, who's already driven it, is saying that it drives great. Like, it's the new standard in sports sedans, gas or electric. I've literally read that from people. That gets me much more excited than the lower cost model as an automotive enthusiast. Look at the price point. 51, you could throw like a bunch, you know, Teslas come basically loaded from the factory, but, you know, pick the color you want, pick the interior you want. And let's say for less than $55,000, you're potentially buying the best sports sedan available in America. That's pretty awesome. You know, the fact that it happens to be fully electric and access to the Tesla Supercharger network is like icing on the cake. That's a really, really attractive price point for a car that is, having not driven it, apparently that impressive.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. So that's, come back to Autoblog, where we cover Tesla, well, obsessively. Autoblog Electra, that's our electric hub for all things EVs. We hit the Tesla earnings and the Model 3 performance pretty hard this week. And by the time you listen to this, perhaps on Friday afternoon, maybe you're heading out for a nice evening round of golf, you will probably have more Tesla news. So let's shift over to Mercedes, where we still have electric news, but this is the Mercedes G-Class that is all new. It's the electric version that we saw revealed this week. The name, it really rolls off the tongue, the G580 with EQ technology. Four motors, it's crazy power. It looks exactly like you would expect a G-Class to look like. And I think this is pretty awesome. I think it really gives, you know, it gives a ton of capability. And I think obviously they got the design right, like we thought they would. But it also becomes an even more aspirational item, I would say, for some segments who, you know, want this type of vehicle, but also want it to be a little bit different than, say, like the AMG or something. So yeah. I'm liking it.
I am in general liking it as well. I think when it comes to something like a G-Class, the rationality of the vehicle is so far down the line of purchase considerations that I'm not sure how much certain specs matter. But here's just a couple. 4.7 seconds 0 to 62, so let's call it 4.5 to 0 to 60. That is awesome. The horsepower rating Greg already mentioned, you know, it's stupid. 879 horsepower, 859 pound-feet of torque. Just for the record, that's 302 more horsepower and 232 more pound-feet than the AMG G63. Which is already a stupid overpowered big brick of an SUV. So that's super awesome. It's got 116 kilowatt hour battery pack. They say 294 miles on the European WLTP test cycle. That is grossly inaccurate for the United States. And as an electric vehicle owner, let me be the first one to tell you, grossly inaccurate in the real world. As a good rule of thumb with a vehicle like this that is not going to be super efficient and is more for power and more for looks, this thing more aerodynamic, but it's still, you know, our writer called it a cinder block, and it's not wrong, a 7,716 pound cinder block. You maybe take that 116 kilowatt hours and double it, and that's likely what you're going to get in range. Our writer thought maybe around 250 miles. I think in reality, it's going to be lower than that, especially as you dip into that crazy, you know, power figure. Double that 116, I think you'll see more like 230 miles in the real world, which is not great. Charging speeds 200 kilowatts, which is decent, but far short of, you know, some EVs 350 kilowatts. So let's just call this what it is. It is Mercedes GMC's, it's Mercedes GMC Hummer. It is a, not a volume vehicle. They're going to be happy to sell, you know, numbers in the hundreds, maybe the low thousands. That's what this is going to be. It's going to be a halo. It's going to be amazing off-road. It's going to be stupid fast on-road, just like the GMC Hummer. I tend to think that, you know, auto enthusiasts like us are going to continue saying like, oh, the GMC Hummer is dumb. Whereas we're going to be like, oh, this AMG electric G-Class is pretty sweet. That's, I think, silly. I think, you know, in the same way that I think the GMC Hummer is awesome as a rolling showcase, I think the G-Class, which I wish they would have just called it the EQG, and not this crazy stupid name. But whatever, I think it's going to be a very impressive vehicle, and I'm excited about it.
All right. Sounds good. So check out that full story. We have a freelancer, Tim Stevens, actually wrote that story for us. I believe he's seen the vehicle, and it's definitely a stunning, new iteration of the G-Class for Mercedes. Let's move over to staying with the German side of the business. The UAW has won the right to organize the Volkswagen Chattanooga factory. This is the first time that the UAW will get to organize a factory in the American South that didn't, you know, belong to one of the Detroit Three. Like GM, of course, has factories in Texas and, you know, other parts of the South. But this is the first time for, a new organization effort like that. It passed with 73% of the vote, which was a very high figure. I think it's even higher than some individual factories ratified the deal with the Detroit Three last fall. So clearly, I think UAW President Sean Thain has created a broader labor movement. He's tapped into the goodwill that many people are feeling for this, for this movement. And obviously you saw that in Chattanooga. I think the next vote is coming up later in May. I think it's the 13th at the Mercedes plant in Vance, Alabama. Speaking of Mercedes, it's tough to look into my crystal ball because the situations are different. You know, you can't just say, hey, this is going to happen. Right now, I would say the union does have a lot of momentum on their side. And I think if they can, tip Mercedes, that's like another domino that falls. Perhaps they try to go for one of the Hyundai or Kia plants. It's also in the deep South. And what I think is really interesting is, and I don't want to get into the politics of it, but for the companies themselves, my guess is if you asked a Volkswagen or Mercedes executive, they would prefer probably not to have the union if you asked them that. But in their home countries of Germany, they have very strong labor unions, and they have for decades. So I feel like, now that this has taken place at Volkswagen and may in fact also happen at Mercedes, I feel like the companies themselves are just going to kind of take it as like a normal part of business operations. So I think, we'll see how things go. But I don't think, Mercedes in particular is going to actively fight it. They take like a neutral position, which, according to like federal law, they sort of have to. But that's kind of my read on the situation. And I think I think maybe 60-40, I think, chances it passes, looking into my crystal ball. And, Tuscaloosa, I'm not like, I've been to that factory. I was there once for a C-Class event. I don't know. I can't see the future, but I would, if I were a betting man, I think 60% chance it passes at the Mercedes factory.
Yeah. And, I think you're spot on, Greg. I also think of the, like you said, Kia, Hyundai, Nissan's got, plants, Toyota's got plants, Texas, but you look at here's why it matters. If you look at the numbers between unionized plants and non-unionized plants, the pay at the union, and this is not a political statement at all. It's literally just facts. The pay at a unionized plant is higher. The workers will end up negotiating contracts that will be more favorable to them. They will end up pocketing more money at the end of the year through whatever means, whether it's through profit sharing or whether it's through higher wages. They'll win some things on healthcare. And that will in turn either mean the cars are going to be priced slightly higher, or it means that profit margins will go, you know, commensurately down. It's just a fact of that's what unions do. They negotiate a little bit more of the money for the workers as opposed to the, you know, the coffers of the car companies themselves. So you might not care about union news and UAW or whatever. You might just kind of like fast forward through the segment if it's just not your interest level. But it does matter in, you know, for the lives of workers, what they're going to be able to negotiate, and potentially either for the cost of a vehicle that's built out of a union or non-union plant, and or the profit margins that the company is able to eke out building vehicles in that particular plant. So it matters. It's kind of boring to talk about, but yes, this is, if you look at it one way, this might be the first domino that's going to fall. Is it going to hit the next domino? Is that one going to fall, or is this going to be a one-off? That's really what's going to make this into a minor footnote in history or a major conversation on future podcasts.
It's interesting too, because, you know, you look at the Detroit Three, they spent, you know, billions of dollars in stock buybacks too after the UAW deal went through last fall. So there's always kind of that, you know, I think the narrative that some of the executives try to like really put out there, like, well, car costs are going to go up. Well, they could for certain vehicles, but they also didn't after the UAW deal last fall. So it's, there's a lot going on. It's definitely complicated. Mercedes, for example, can and does charge about as much as it wants for vehicles, right, and has some of the best profit margins in the industry. And they also already have unionized plants. In fact, if you look at like their factory in Alabama, that's one of the few factories they have that isn't unionized. So, it's interesting.
Go ahead. It also depends on what vehicles they're building at the plant.
That's true.
It could have an impact on what they choose to build where. So a vehicle that has a higher profit margin, a high price SUV, a high price pickup truck makes a lot more sense to build at a unionized factory where the wages are higher than a, you know, low cost hatchback or sedan or something like that. So, you know, let's say the Kia plant were to unionize, Kia plant in Georgia were to unionize, will they then choose to build, you know, larger, more expensive, three row SUVs there as opposed, like the Telluride, as opposed to smaller two-row, lower profit margin vehicles like the Sportage? Who knows? But those kind of decisions do get made in boardrooms based on the profitability of plants. So, you know, a lot of long-reaching ramifications in the future, depending on how many dominoes end up falling.
A relatively small vehicle that's made in America, about 40 miles from where I'm sitting, and I believe is quite profitable, is the Ford Mustang. You went to its 60th birthday party last week, and I think you were down in North Carolina, right?
That's correct. Yeah, Charlotte Motor Speedway.
Down in Charlotte. Yeah. We talked about this a little bit last week on the cast, but tell me, what was it like? What was the vibe down there? How did this special edition Mustang look in person? I kind of like it. The pictures, I think, don't really do it justice, but what'd you think?
Yeah, I was a little disappointed in the image gallery that Ford released on the vehicle base, you know, in comparison to what I saw in real life. And I mean, check out Autoblog's social media channels and YouTube channels. We put up some of our own videos that I shot while I was down there. It's a pretty cool vehicle. It's Wimbledon white, which is a classic Mustang color. The one that they had on display, with red badging, and, it kind of sounds weird to say this, But the coolest,
say it.
Yeah, the coolest thing about it is how much effort they put into the badging. Like normally I'm not one to like say like, oh, it's a trim and sticker package that is really cool. Well, this is kind of a trim and sticker package that is kind of cool. They, you know, longtime auto enthusiasts, who remember vehicles from the 1960s and maybe into the 70s, maybe are very familiar with removing, badging from their vehicles. I used to have a series of Pontiac GTOs when I was young, or they were at least in my family. I didn't own them all. But those badges had heft, you know, they were like die cast. They were, like hand painted, you know, GTO 6.6 liter or, you know, whatever. The badges on this Mustang kind of harken back to that same time period. They are, I overheard a conversation. I don't know if anyone knows who Jason Torchinski is. He's an editor over at the Autopian, used to be at Jalopnik. That guy will geek out over badges and taillights and things like that, like no one I've ever met. And he was having a conversation at the end of my table, and I went and sat down there and was kind of overhearing the Mustang designers talk to him. They did a lot of cool things with these badges. They're like legit, have heft to them, were really thought out, done in cool colors. They say 5.0. But they really look like they might have been something designed in the mid-1960s. To me, that was the coolest part. There's no additional performance out of the thing. I do think it's cool that they went with the GT Premium Pack, and they're giving people the choice to choose whether they want a hardtop or a convertible, and they're allowing them to choose an automatic or a manual. That's cool. They're only building 1,965 of them. They haven't announced the pricing on them yet, but assuming it's reasonable, why wouldn't you put your, and you wanted a Mustang, why wouldn't you put your name in line for one of those limited edition, less than 2,000, special editions only for the 2025 model year? That's kind of how I'm looking at it. And when you look at it through that lens, you're like, yeah, that's cool. It would have been awesome if they'd have figured out a way to pump 25 more horsepower through it, or, you know, a different engine tune, or, you know, a different exhaust or some, I don't know, whatever. Maybe even a different hood scoop or something. There's no performance advantage to it at all. But as an appearance package, at least it's a pretty cool one.
Cool.
I think, just looking at it, I agree with you. It is a cool badge, and little things like that, you know, going back to like even things like the bronze wheels on a BMW M3, we had the fleet and some other vehicles, the badges, the wheels, that all that stuff matters. It's why we like cars, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
One of the they also had another kind of cool Easter egg. You can configure the instrument cluster to look like a 1967 Mustang, I believe, which goes with, it's like an over-the-air kind of flash update. So you get that kind of like very instrumented metal, like old school gauges displayed digitally, of course, which is a nice complement to the Fox body update that you could get that's already available in Mustangs. So pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah, it was cool. I wish Ford would have told us about that ahead of time so we'd have seen it, but they wanted it to be a, in their own words, quote unquote, a surprise birthday present for 7th gen Mustang owners. So yeah, that's cool. Nice work on that, Ford.
Cool. All right. Did you know the Aston Martin badges are made by a very famous jeweler in London? I went on one of the like DB11, I think it was, trips a few years ago, and they had the badges there, and these guys with white gloves were showing them, and they were like heavy and had some real like actual, I mean, it literally probably added a pound or two to the weight of the car. Mm-hmm. So companies do some cool things with the badges and obviously the hood ornaments, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Less these days though, you know,
less and less. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. You know, it's kind of the same way as like housing construction. You look at houses that were built in, you know, earlier in the 1900s, and the level of craftsmanship on like trim work and stuff like that compared to what they do today, where, you know, they're like, which type of fake stonework do you want on the front of your home? You know, it's kind of the same way with cars. why go through the effort of paying, you know, let's say each one of those, even on the mass market, costs $25, each one of those badges. Why do that times four on a vehicle for $100 of profit they're never going to get back, versus just, you know, a sticker that goes across, or, you know, you know, 25-cent fake plastichrome that sticks on the back. You know, that's the majority of what happens in the world. So when car companies kind of, you know, throw back like that and do something cool, it's a small point, but if you're an enthusiast, I think it's an appreciated one.
I mean, it's like crown molding, you know, buy a house built in like the 20s, 30s, and 40s, boom, crown molding.
Yeah.
Our first house had built-in bookshelves in this one upstairs room. It was like a library. I wish I still had that office, not the house, but that specific room. It was the perfect work from home office.
That sounds awesome.
But yeah, that's, you buy a house that's 30, 40 years newer, you know, forget about it. That's just not the level of craftsmanship that you would see.
Same thing with cars. Just different.
Same thing with cars. Well, now that we're taking kind of a darker trim, the legacy's done. I think this makes a fair amount of sense for Subaru, just given the downturn in the overall sedan market, although there's plenty of exceptions like Honda, Hyundai, that have found traction there and been willing to accept perhaps a smaller raw figure, but still robust, healthy segment for their bottom line. I can't say I'm surprised. And frankly, if you read Subaru's press release, it's surprisingly blunt. They like lay out their reasons, which I applaud. Maybe they bring the legacy back, use the name for something else. Maybe they end up making a sedan down the road. Who knows? We'll see. But this is it for the legacy. And I have some good memories of driving. I've driven basically every legacy since 2008. So I always thought it's been different things. At times it did feel cheap to me. I feel like you're driving this like plasticky interior with kind of quirky styling, but you get all wheel drive and the price was often competitive. Mm-hmm. Steering was usually pretty good. Like Subaru does their chassis right. But again, you get in like a Hyundai and the interior is way nicer for even like a cheaper trim. Same with even like Fords and things like that at the time. It was almost like an all wheel drive Chevy. I don't know how to put that. So any legacy memories as you reflect on the legacy's legacy?
Yeah, I had to use the word legacy when I'm the one who wrote this story, the end of the line story. The legacy's legacy. It's the best selling Subaru nameplate in history. That's interesting. Over 1.3 million sold in since 1989. Vehicle designed specifically for America. And when you look at it that way, well, what do Americans want these days? They want the Outback. They don't want the Legacy. So let's be very clear. The Legacy is going away. The Outback is not. And that basically tells you all you need to know about, the market realities and why this is happening. The Legacy is, I think it's almost surprising that it lasted as long as it did. But I think part of that is simply because the Legacy and the Outback, have always been co-developed. The Legacy first, and then when the Outback came on into the market, RIP, Paul Hogan, not that he, RIP his commercials. People want to buy the Outback. They don't want to buy the Legacy, and Subaru would rather sell an Outback anyway because they sell it for a higher cost. And most of that is pure profit because the underlying bits, the engines, the transmissions, even the all-wheel drive systems are, for all intents and purposes, roughly the same. So it's almost surprising. The only reason the Legacy has been around as long as it has is because they already put the development work into the Outback. But I guess a line has been crossed where the return on investment to build a second model, even though it's roughly the same car parts, they probably crossed that line and they're just letting it die a natural death. And I think it'd be cool if a future electric vehicle, because they've got a bunch in the works, if a future electric vehicle maybe drew from I hate to keep saying this, but the legacy of the legacy. Maybe they can, maybe the legacy's future isn't completely sealed off. They could break that name back out again. I also wonder if Subaru fans care all that much about, you know, oh, this long-running, best-selling Subaru nameplate is gone now. I don't think people would care as much as, like, oh, the Camaro's gone. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, if you were to say we're stopping the Mustang, which we're just talking about after 60 years. People care about that. I don't know how many people actually care about the end of the legacy nameplate. But, you know, the legacy went from just a family car with all-wheel drive to, you know, a legitimate, like, performance sporty option. I'm sure you remember the 3.6Rs and the 2.5 XTs. Those kind of went by the wayside, but it still is a good car. And one that I recommend to people if they're looking at, you know, Camrys and Accords, like, well, don't sleep on the Subaru Legacy. You can probably get a good deal on one. And it's a very competent vehicle. And I guess at least it's dying a competent, reasonably priced vehicle.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Instead of letting them wither on the vine as not even competitive.
Yeah, I see a future where they bring it back. Remember at one point they called it the Legacy Outback for the mm-hmm. Outback variant. I'm not convinced sedans are dead forever, but it's just the market style or the segment isn't there. It's also a situation where maybe if it is, we just live in this world of ubiquitous crossovers, mm-hmm. maybe a slightly smaller kind of compact item is called the Legacy with yeah. some car-like styling. I don't know.
Now, I'm not going to lie. I mean, I'd rather have an Outback than a Legacy. How about you?
Yeah, me too. 100%. I like how it looks better. It's more functional.
Ground clearance is a little bit better if you do go camping or something like that, you know?
Yeah, it's not that much more money too. Like yeah. you, that's the other problem with a lot of these smaller vehicles is, you know, there is like a baseline of just how much a vehicle costs outside of a true econo box. And it's like, well, I can pay this much or I can pay a little bit more and get this. So it's, yeah. it's a challenge.
And you start looking at the monthly payment too. You're like, what is it?
Oh yeah.
$35 more a month to get the one you'd rather have. Mm-hmm. And then you're like, oh, well that's, you know, that's one pizza dinner out.
Right.
And you're like, well, I'm just going to get the Outback then. I mean, that's probably the decision-making process of a lot of Americans that are choosing Outback over a Legacy.
Side note, I'm not sure if you were in Seattle at the time. Were you there for the first drive? This is probably three generations ago in like 2009 or 10 of the Legacy. It was in Seattle.
I was there for it, but I didn't go. I did
go.
I did go. Was it 2013 or 2014?
Yeah.
Where they did when they switched over to the new global platform. I was on that one, and that's what the current Legacy is still based on. And
yeah,
I'm also like, you'd be surprised if you haven't driven one, just how competent the Legacy is as a family sedan. It is pretty darn good.
Yeah, no, I believe it. We had a long termer at Auto Week. I did that first drive there in Seattle. I spent a lot of time in the Legacy, and I think it's it was a good soldier for a long time, and you know.
Yeah, I was still in Phoenix. I was still in Phoenix at that time. Yeah, I wasn't the natural choice for that, but so I wouldn't have seen you there in a past life. But yeah, the Legacy's got a long history of you know, pretty good vehicles. You know, so I guess we can just, you know, salute it off into the automotive sunset for now and say Legacy. It at least you've always been a good car. We're sad to see you go, but at least you're not dying as an also-ran afterthought.
All right. Better to die a hero than live long enough to be a villain, as they say. Do you think Kia should do a pickup truck? We saw the Tasman revealed this week. It's kind of crazy sort of livery. It was like a company sort of teaser. This would take aim against the Ranger and Toyota's entry in global markets. No word on if it'll come to the United States. It actually looks like a pretty good truck. I mean, a very boxy, upright, you know, kind of looks like a Nissan Frontier to me. Do you think Kia should be the one to randomly bring a truck to the United States? Do you think they should bring the Tasman here?
That's a solid yes.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. I mean, what better market for a global car company to enter into the United States than pickup truck? There's a caveat there. They really would have to build that thing in the United States to avoid the chicken tax, right?
Yes.
So they'd have to build it in the US. We were just talking about unionizing plants and high profit margin vehicles and, hey, pickup truck. One thing that I like about it is, it is very clearly not a Hyundai Santa Cruz. Not that I don't like the Santa Cruz. I think that's cool. The easy way out would be for, Kia America to say, yeah, we want a pickup truck. We're going to take the Santa Cruz and we're going to modify it a little bit. You know, in the same way that, Tucson and a Sportage are, you know, maybe they're built on the same platform, or the Palisade and the, the Telluride, are built on the same platform. They could take the Santa Cruz platform and make a truck out of it. The Tasman looks like a legit, as Greg already said, a legit boxy, high ground clearance, like good utility vehicle, which is cool. Why not like enter the booming, currently booming midsize truck market? And, you know, I don't think you're going to convert a whole bunch of Tacoma owners into Kia Tasman owners. But if you could get enough Frontier, Ranger, Colorado buyers, if you could get enough of them to, you know, sell, or even, you know, Gladiator buyers, if you get enough of them to switch over and say like, yeah, I'll give Kia a look, and you sell 30,000-35,000 of them a year at solid profit margins, why not?
Yeah. I'm going to go out and say no. I think the midsize truck market is already crowded enough. I don't think, you know, Mercedes talked about it with that. I think they called it, was it the X-Class, which I actually thought was cool. But they had the fortune or misfortune of having Dr. Z. Dieter Zesha in charge at the time, who was the former CEO of Chrysler and then CEO of Daimler Chrysler. And he was like, listen, everybody, I know how to make a truck in the United States. I know what a truck is. This ain't it. So we're not going to do it. So, and I thought that appeared to be a more credible entry than this. This, I think, would be fine. I think we'd love it in the press fleets. I just don't think they would ever sell enough of them to make it more of a trivia question. I think we were talking about the Suzuki Equator a while back. I think that's what this would be. Maybe they sell 20,000 of them. It goes on for a few years the way we go. Your path, I think, is a smart one, though. Find a platform. You know, maybe see what the Santa Cruz is on, maybe throw a Kia badge on it, a very nice badge, you know, like the 60th anniversary Mustang. You could do it that way. But I'm just like, when I look at the overall case, this looks kind of cool, but I don't think this needs to come here. I think the midsize, small to midsize market is very flooded right now. So, and I think that's a good thing. I love that segment. It's one of my favorites. So
yeah, it is interesting, yeah, the different takes on that. I guess I think part of it, you touched on this a little bit, the quality of the product would be key to the decision. Could Kia be successful with a midsize truck? My take on that is yes, they could be. Your take on maybe this isn't the one, you know, maybe this isn't the right, you know, the right segment or time to bring it. I see both sides of the argument. I would hope that Kia engineers could engineer a truck, you know, that would you know, stack up well against a you know, a Ranger or something like that. But yeah, there's a lot that we don't know about it yet, so it's kind of hard to say, right?
All right, let's shift over to our road test section. We've been driving some interesting things. I have been in our long-term Mazda CX-90, and you've been in a BMW X2. The X2 has always been, I think, kind of an odd duck in the BMW lineup. You drove it, I believe you drove it in Europe, right?
I did.
So why don't you tell me about it? And I'm curious just too, in addition to the impressions, what have you thought about the X2? I just think it's such kind of a interesting space. Let's put it that way.
It's kind of weird.
BMW
slices up their SUV. Well, if you ask them, the SAV, sports activity vehicle, not a sport utility vehicle. They slice up their segments much more dicey than any of their competitors do. You know, you might not know just looking at them that the X1 and X2 are basically the same thing. One of them has a you know, cut down roof and more aggressive styling. That's the X2, and a slightly, you know, altered price point because of it. I think the X2 makes almost zero sense at all in its base form. I don't know, there's not a lot of Americans out there that are like, yeah, give me the one with less utility for slightly higher price. You know, that's not a typical American car buying mentality. Some people are like, yeah, I want that. You know, the ones that, you know, live at home, serial bachelors, or, you know, maybe, you know, couples that have no intent on, you know, working on homes, apartment, livers, whatever. I don't think that makes sense at all. I think the X2 makes its most sense in its high-end trims. The one that I drove was the M-badged variant, and that one is the one that I think makes the most sense. Now, let's just throw this out there right now. Even though I'm saying that, BMW will offer the same performance options and the same performance trim on the X1 as well. And if I were buying, that's the direction I'd go, because I appreciate the greater utility, in the back seat and, you know, the more kind of traditional, utility styling. But for those that are attracted to the aggressive looking and aggressively styled X2, I think the M series, like what I drove, with the, 312 horsepower turbocharged engine, makes the most sense.
Okay. And if it were my money, I'd go with the 2 Series coupe. I think I would, you know, not thinking practically, but just as far as price points and small BMWs, I would veer into that side of things.
Oh, I'm totally with you. Give me BMW's rear wheel drive coupe platform for absolute sure. And I would say the same thing to those people who are looking at something like an X2. Like, are you sure that's what you want? Like, I think it makes the most sense, but you know, is it actually the best choice? That's maybe a different question. But yeah, I'm with you on that, Greg.
How does this thing drive? Just, you know, give me, where did you drive it? What'd you think? How was the steering? It's a BMW. You got to ask about the steering. How was it?
I will say that BMW's front wheel drive biased platforms have made great leaps and bounds in steering feel. I will say that it is styled aggressively. It's got the most powerful 4-cylinder 2-liter turbocharged engine. Across BMW's range, it's over 300 horsepower. It's quick, 8-speed automatic transmission. It drives good. It is oddly aggressive, and that the term aggressive is a nice way to say firm, stiff, hard, crashy. It on really smooth, quiet roads, like when I lived in Phoenix, and they have great pavement out in Phoenix, wide open spaces, a car like that is really nice. You live in the Midwest, and a car like that is going to feel like punishment. It's very stiff. BMW in the past has had like setting upon setting upon setting where you could move some dials and say like, okay, I'm going to purposely put this suspension in its, most compliant form, comfort mode, so to speak, put the steering in performance, put the engine in performance aggressive, and you didn't have to like crash over every pothole. The way that they're doing it now is they're making drive modes, and they're giving them, you know, names like I don't have it directly in front of me, but they're making like, instead of just saying like I'm gonna have comfort mode for my suspension and sport mode for my steering, you're just clicking a dial and saying I want this in its most aggressive mode, and it changes everything. The suspension is still like the damping is controlled electronically, but there's no easy way. It is still possible in some instances to set like personal modes, but those are buried in menus. It's not as simple as turning a dial on your center console to, you know, sport for the transmission or engine tuning and leaving everything else in comfort mode. They're really trying to do that for you, for drivers that basically just want to get in the car and say like, yeah, I'm feeling sporty aggressive today. So you go into that mode. And everything changes all at once. Like even the coloring of the car and the lighting of the dash, like it all changes all at the same time, which makes sense on some level to people who don't want to dial things down, but it's just tuned so aggressively that I think it's actually way too much for huge swaths of the country that are just going to be, you know, not going to want to use those modes, like the sport mode, because it's just too, it's just way too hardcore.
Cool.
Where did you drive it again? You were in Europe, Portugal. Specifically. What? Portugal. Okay. That's a good part of the country, of yeah. the world to drive things.
So we did the X2, the Mini Countryman, in both, gas powered S and electric trim, SE trim. The Mini made significantly less sense to me being so crashy and boundy over bumps. It was similarly tuned too aggressively in my viewpoint. But I thought the X2 made a little bit more sense simply because you know what you're buying when you buy the X2. You like, you walk up to it, you look at it, it's low slung, it's, you know, sits tight on its wheels. Like it is very clearly a hardcore performance oriented model by design. So you know what you're getting into when you strap yourself into the seat and the first time you hit a speed bump and you're like, whoa, that is stiff. Like that's not a surprise. Whereas you get into a Mini and you're kind of like, holy crap, that was a big clash over that pothole. I don't know that I really expected that. So that's totally a viewpoint thing. That's just a personal opinion. But that's kind of what I thought. Very, very aggressive. I think when I wrote the first drive review on the Countryman, I said, I think maybe wait for the, you know, don't go the John Cooper works, get the S. That's going to be more, you know, a little bit more comfortable, a little bit less aggressively tuned, and probably better in the real world. For the X2, I was like, well, if you're buying an X2 and not an X1, you did that on purpose. So maybe you're looking for the most aggressively tuned one. That's kind of how I broke them up. And it's kind of how I framed my first drive reviews on those two, which you can read on Autoblog if you go to the BMW X2 page. The most recent review that you'll find is the one that I wrote on that.
Nice segue, nice call out. So do check that story out. We will close out the drives portion of the show with an update on our long-termer. It's in my garage. This is the Mazda CX-90, the plug-in hybrid. That offers you about 26-ish miles of range. I have not charged it yet, but it's really on my to-do list of things. Well, to do. I did gas it up, so sort of living the suburban three-row crossover life. Ours is a beautiful shade of white. The out-the-door pricing is about 60 grand. Check out, you know, our long-term garage on the site. You can see everything you need to know about this. I'm still liking it. And I still have, I'd say, the same feelings that I sort of reported last week. Really sporty steering and a relatively, I would say, well-sorted, stiff isn't the right word, but sporty-ish suspension. Great looks. The steering at times is a little bit heavy. And I would say this, I feel like when you're driving a three-row crossover, you're like sipping a coffee, you're refereeing the kids, maybe there's a dog running around, and you're steering one-handed. That's not a good thing, it just is. And in this thing, you really don't want to do that. You want to have 10 and 2, you want to be focused, and that's a good thing. But I will say this, like compared to say, I'll pick a crossover out of thin air, the Ford Explorer, the Kia Telluride, it's a different driving dynamic. So you got to test drive one of these things before you know what you're signing up for. So
that's an interesting viewpoint. And it's a conversation we have a lot in our Slack channels. We've got some younger drivers. Greg and I are part of the older crew that you're listening to right now. And sometimes we have a slightly different take on like the drive experience of a vehicle like that. I could see some of our younger guys, Zach, Joel, getting into it and feeling and saying something like, finally, a three-row crossover made for a driving enthusiast. You know, whereas someone like you or I, who, you know, is a little bit older, maybe is putting people in the passenger seat, maybe even someone in the third row from time to time, doing daily driver duties with a cup of coffee in your hand and, you know, several cell phones throughout plugged into USBs. And sometimes you're not looking for a aggressive Miata-like driving experience, mm-hmm. you know, and other times you are. You know, so I think it's awesome that Mazda is sticking to its guns and making a three row crossover that carries over that kind of zoom sporty driving you know style that Mazda is known for. But I think before you make a purchase, you have to ask yourself, is that what you want? You know, like for a lot of people, yeah. for a good enough people, maybe it is. You know, like okay. I need a three row crossover. I at least want one that's super fun to drive. Awesome.
Yes.
But you know, if you're constantly schlepping kids back and forth to school and that's the vehicle's main, main role, maybe it's not the one you want. And that's why we get these for a year and live with them and report back. Like I could totally see a whole big, large percentage of the population saying, yeah, it's exactly what I've been waiting for. And I could see an equal size saying like, yeah, give me the comfortable one.
Yeah, no, exactly. As far as the like the daily duties though, it's very functional. Mm-hmm. I have a set of golf clubs in the back seat, probably a couple of like camping chairs for soccer practice. Groceries are going back there. There's a fair amount of room back there. Like it's definitely a functional vehicle, a lot of room back there. And also something that is distinctive and I think in a good way is the styling. It looks yeah. sporty, it looks like a Mazda. I think if you're a Mazda fan, or even if you're not, you'll look at that and say, oh, that's a sharp crossover.
Yeah, so, I love the way that looks.
Yeah, me too.
I'm the first car that I ever actually went to a dealership and bought with my own money was an RX-8 in 2004, oh, right when it came out. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely loved the thing. One of the things that I loved about it was, despite it being super sporty and really fun to drive, it was relatively comfortable. I have not driven our new long-termer yet, the mm-hmm. CX-90. I am excited to do so. I wonder, for me, someone who, you know, I love the sporty side of things, but I also have to buy for practicality's sake. I wonder if it would be a sweet spot for me. Maybe in a future podcast, I'll report back after actually getting a chance to drive the thing. It might be one of those vehicles that like I really like the Acura MDX as a three row. It's much stiffer mm-hmm. than say like a Lexus RX, but not like too sporty for me. I wonder if the Mazda is kind of going to be along that same vibe. Stay tuned in a future podcast episode when I let you know my thoughts on that. So excited to give it a try.
All right. Sounds good. All right. Well, that's all the time we have this week. Thanks for hanging out, Jeremy. You have any spring beer recommendations or wine? We started off with some aperitifs. Let's end with them.
Yeah. You know what? A friend was nice enough to bring me some Leavenworth Washington beer.
Okay.
We're literally just ending the winter season and moving into spring. And that means in the Midwest, you've got a lot of days where it's like 70s and beautiful. And then you wake up the next morning and it's 29 and overcast. So on those 29 and overcast days, I've got a dark persuasion beer. It is German chocolate cake in a can.
Whoa.
Yeah. Okay. And it's amazing. For those really beautiful sunny days, my wife and I have been drinking, Vino Verde wines from Portugal. That is the
sounds good.
That's they refer to them as green wines. They're all white grapes, but the Green Valley wines a little bit of effervescence, drier, more dry than sweet, but a little bit of effervescence, low ABV. They're like 9-10% wines, not 12-14% wines. So easy drinking on a nice sunny day. So in this springtime period, we're kind of going back and forth between dark beers, like that, Icicle Brewery, Dark Persuasion from Leavenworth, Washington, and then moving on to the, Vino Verde wines from Portugal on the, nice sunny spring days.
All right.
So how about you?
Well, let's see. I've been kind of all over the place. I've been drinking Coors Light, which is a very hard thing to recommend, but it's just, it was kind of hot for a while. So lawnmower beer, I cut the grass for the first time. And I was like, yeah, you kind of have a Coors Light. It just kind of felt like the thing to have. I'm not going to recommend that. But I have been enjoying some Heinekens on the patio as well. Kind of as the sun goes down, you get a nice kind of springtime sunset. It's a nice way to, as the days are starting to get downright longish, you know, have a beer, and it's still kind of chilly. You don't get, to your point, it's such a unique time of the year, mm-hmm. sort of like kind of late fall where, you know, only in fall the days are short, but like you can be awake and around and it's convenient to enjoy the sunset and have a drink. So
yeah, I hear you on Coors Light. I usually go to the champagne of beers. A good old Miller High Life is my long.
That's a good one. That's college right there.
Yeah. Well, some of us never grow old, I guess.
I could drink that on a golf course too. That's another good one. It's got to be out of the bottles though, I think.
Get the beer cart coming across
the
on the
beer cart. Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Totally. Cool.
All right. Well, cool. So if you enjoy the show, please give us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you might find the Autoblog podcast. If you'd like us to spend your money, we actually have a few of them now. We're going to start trying to churn those out in the coming weeks or get into the mailbag. We've received some great questions. There's one about Rivian. We'll have fun getting into that in the coming weeks. That's podcast@autoblog.com. Be safe out there, and we'll see you next week.